Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get this property tax relief, the local sales tax division hearing, call it to order. We've got some motions we need to make, but we'll wait until we get a quorum for that. But ladies and gentlemen, you're in for a double feature tonight. Not only do you get the property tax markup bill as the first feature, but then the tax committee comes on for the encore. So you're going to get double the pleasure for your money tonight. Y'all, believe it or not, back in 1977...
Can we vote on that, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Larry Madden, no, I don't dare vote on that. But I remember... did you put that in your motion?
No. Mr. Chairman, I did just want to make a comment that the star of the show is the property tax man.
I remember a double feature I went to before my wife and I were married, but we were going out. It was 1977, and the first movie was Carrie. Remember that with Sissy Spacek? And then the next movie was Rocky, the first Rocky. And it was that combination, if you can believe, at one of the Fargo theaters back in that day. So I don't know if this is going to match that at all, but Carrie and Rocky were the two movies. All right, tonight we're going to first of all hear testimony. And do we have a list right now yet, or are we just going to... Okay, we've got a list, but I see there's the first group that would like to speak is a city group, and then after that, for or against, if you would come down, and please keep your comments, of course, to the point, and a lot of this has been discussed before, but we certainly want to hear everyone's opinion on this, and welcome, Mr. Carlson, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I would like to talk today briefly about the LGA piece in Article 2, and later on I'll have some other comments or general work on my staff. We'll have some other comments about other aspects of the bill. But I'd like to focus on Article 2 dealing with local government aid. I'd like to start by thanking Chair Marquardt and the committee for understanding the difficult challenges faced by cities over the past several years. Since the last major state budget crisis in 2003, the appropriation for LGA has remained more than $100 million lower than the pre-reduction level. As a result, city property taxes have steadily risen since 2004, and absent any intervention by the legislature, we expect this trend to continue into the foreseeable future. We certainly acknowledge the fact that the state is facing another budget crisis, and we are collectively thankful that the solutions being discussed by the House, Senate, and Governor do not impose further cuts in state aid to cities. Rather, we're looking at a bill here that's before you today that has $30 million of additional resources for LGA, and we certainly thank you for taking steps to address our needs, even with your own budget crisis. That said, we would have preferred that the proposal developed by the city organizations and introduced as House File 3756, that was Chair Marquardt's bill, have been included in this bill. And let me give you just a brief background of why we think that's an important bill. Last session, we had two competing LGA proposals, one offered by the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and one offered by the Metro Cities Organization. And these proposals were in addition to another bill that was brought forward by the League to address the volatility of the LGA formula. And as we looked at those three proposals, we understood that there was a growing consensus that there was dissatisfaction for a variety of reasons with the current LGA formula. It was clear that we had to take some action. Last year's vetoed tax bill would have had $70 million of additional money in the formula, and it really did not make any significant formula revisions, but it did include also a study of LGA with the intent that over the long term we would be developing a longer-term fix for LGA, and that's what our proposal embodied in House File 3756 would have also done. During last year's debate, we also heard from many key legislators, including Chair Marquardt. We heard from him telling us to get together and come up with an idea that would work better and that you could all agree with. And we spent the last summer months and early into this session discussing ideas among our city organizations, including the Small Cities Association, the Metro Cities, the North Metro Mayors Association, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and the League of Cities, and individual cities were also involved. and we came together with the proposal that was authored by Representative Marquardt. And we think that that did have some major advantages. It did address some of the problems with the current system, including the side pots, the volatility, the appropriation level, and the distribution of the resources. Our proposal included an elimination of the regional center side pot, as I said. It included a new jobs-based formula factor, which we think was a good proxy for measuring overburden of cities. And it did also adjust the small cities formula by increasing the per capita distribution to cities under 5,000 population. We did ask for a $90 million appropriation increase. We did realize that the resources were scarce, and we formulated that bill to include an adjustable mechanism to allow different appropriation levels to be included. Let me conclude, Chair Marquardt, by just saying that is this a perfect formula? No, we know it's not. If it were, we would not have included the legislative study in the bill that you authored. We felt that this was a good first step, a temporary transitional tool, and we do give you our word that we are looking and participating in a longer-term discussion for LGA reform. So, long and short, we would have preferred to see the House File 3756 language included in its entirety within that bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Peterson. I am here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I'd like to start by saying thanks for the increase of $30 million in local government aid. We are very glad to see that the legislature is interested in continuing to fund the LGA and increase LGA. At the same time, we are a little disappointed. We are disappointed because the coalition, along with the other organizations, put a lot of time and effort and regressions and runs and analysis and meetings and arguments to reach a agreement on a formula and a base for a formula to move forward for a long sustainable future of the LGA program. We also thought by coming together and creating this formula and this bill that we would also be able to see a larger infusion of money into the LGA program. The chart that I handed out kind of shows the LGA history, and then back in 2003, we were at $587 million. Adjusted for inflation going into 2009, we would be all the way up to $689 million. That's the consumer price inflation, not inflation for state and local governments, which of course is higher because it's a different basket of goods that local governments and state governments buy. With a $30 million increase, we do receive a real increase, which we are glad to see. However, if we continue to not see a large infusion into the LGA program, we have to look at what this means going forward. If you look at the history, when we had the cut of $150 million, we saw our cities buy down their reserves, cut their services, and eventually raise property taxes. And what has happened is the cities that are aid-dependent are starting to have higher tax rates and less services. The cities that are not aid-dependent, that are more property wealth, are able to purchase those services that communities want, that businesses want, that residents want, which means that those communities are more attractive, which, of course, increases their property wealth as more people want to move there or businesses want to move there. On the other hand, you have the low-wealth communities either raising their tax rates higher, which makes them less desirable for residents and businesses, or cutting their services, which makes them less desirable, which of course then creates the disparity that we talk about. Well, high-wealth communities are able to provide the services at a lower rate, low-wealth communities are not. And it kind of just multiply in itself the more, until we put the large infusion back into the LGA program. So I think I'd like to close on that. We understand where you are as far as the budget, but we know that if we do not at some point look in the future to put a large infusion of money into LGA, we will continue to see this disparity amongst cities continue to grow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Jambois, next. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I don't think I can talk as fast as Gary Carlson and Steve Peterson, which means I'll probably have to say less in order to get my testimony in. First, I'd like to mention that we passed out a letter that was addressed to you. It is from all of the groups that put together the consensus
for the Unity proposal, as we call it. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm with Metro Cities. That's 86 members in the fully developed inner ring developing area and the fringe of the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify tonight. And Chair Marquardt, we want to thank you for holding property tax hearings both around the state and in the Twin Cities metro area. We think we had a great opportunity to talk about some important things at those meetings. I'd like to comment on several provisions of the bill, but I'll start with LGA and probably come back with Jen O'Rourke and Gary Carlson when they come back. First, we very much appreciate the increased appropriation for LGA. No, it's not what we asked for, and of course we support Steve Peterson and Gary Carlson's comments, but in light of the general budget reduction for a bunch of activities, and in the recognition of the fact that earlier this decade, LGA took a big share of the hit when we had to reconcile budget problems, we want to thank you for an increase this year. And we ask that you consider our reaction to certain aspects of HF 1222 in that context. About this time last year, we all were summoned to your office, Representative Marquardt, and we were told that we'd better get our act together on LGA if we ever expected any money or an increase. We took that to heart, but we failed to find common ground during the 2007 session, and as a result, we wound up with status quo. We knew that over the interim we were going to have to do better, and we spent countless hours working options and running spreadsheets and arguing nuances, and it wasn't a pretty process. But we came together at the start of the 2008 session based on a consensus that had, I think, four guiding principles. First, the Unity Plan was a short-term measure. It's better than the current program, but it really wasn't built for the long haul. It's a temporary measure. Second, the program, the LGA program, as we know it, must be overhauled, and that overhaul needs to include all of the affected parties. Third, whatever we came up with in the Unity Plan did this was scalable at a variety of appropriation levels. And fourth, to buy time to develop a long-term quality product without conflict that yearly distribution fluctuations create, the plan froze the distribution. Now, we know that some people would consider the freeze to be a grandfather, and we would say that it's not a grandfather. That a grandfather, in its truest sense, intends to maintain the status quo indefinitely, and in fact, our freeze is the antithesis of that. We want to keep this in place for a couple of years while we can study the program and really affect some sweeping change. So the freeze is important to us. In some respects, the most important component, though, is the study. We know that LGA is a very complex program, and we found that in the last couple of years, program reform is easier said than done. Several attempts have been made. We've all made them. Those attempts have ranged from the fairly dramatic to the pretty simple, and they've included changes in the formula, side pots, and a wide array of need and capacity factors. And when we produce spreadsheets from those attempts that we made, more often than not, the end result was worse than what we've got right now. So this is not an easy program to fix. It's not an easy program to do well. But what that experience has told us is that the program improvement will take time and will require the full attention of all the affected parties. So while we very much appreciate your support for increased LGA, we do prefer the Unity Plan because it is temporary. It does include an analysis. It freezes the game for a couple of years. It provides the stability that a freeze provides in order for us to concentrate really on the future. And it is scalable. We'd like the scalability of the program to go up and down with appropriations. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will quit. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Well, and thank you very much. And, you know, I, again, want to thank all of the city groups that did come together on that. And I do think we have the main points of the Unity Plan in place still. I mean, I think everyone considers this, since we do have the study, to be temporary. I mean, I don't think anyone thinks this is the all for everything. I mean, this is temporary. But one of the main points in it is the new jobs base that starts at 5,000 population. I think that was a huge part of that program. We also add money to the small city capita. And when you look at kind of a lot of the things that we wanted to happen on this LGA run, and I think what the Unity groups wanted to do was to get more money into a lot of the first ring suburbs, because there's a lot of factors. I remember last year the testimony with the figures that came from several of the groups, and I'll tell you what, it was very compelling that in fact the formula wasn't matching what we needed in the inner ring suburbs. And you know, in current law, if you take those older cities, which is Anoka, Brooklyn Center, Columbia Heights, and that group, which was really one we were focusing on, if you take the current law, they receive 2.7% of the total LGA pot, 2.7%. They will receive 6.7% of the new dollars. So we certainly are moving dollars in those areas. On the regional centers, they stay pretty close. And also, we don't have $90 million. I mean, we're still, you know, needless to say, you know, we're very limited on the dollars. And just to get 30 in, as many of you mentioned, we tried pretty hard just to get 30 million. And just the way some of the numbers work, especially for the regional centers, we protected some of that regional aid. So that's a difference. But on the regional centers, where right now they make up 20.6% of the LGA pot under current law, they would receive 19.3% of the new dollars. So it's not quite as much, but pretty close. But I do think the major premise of the Unity Plan, and I wouldn't have felt satisfied, and I don't think this group would have felt satisfied putting something together that didn't have the main points of the Unity Plan, because you guys all came together on this and did a fantastic job. So I think the fact that it had to be scaled back from 90 back to 30, we had to take a few of the bells and whistles off, probably, to make it work in this and so forth. But I do think with the job base being, you know, one of the major components, and with the 5,000 population, that was huge. And we didn't freeze it. We had a lot of, you know, debate on that, but we didn't freeze it. And yet, we do have this study. And so I think whatever we have here, no one's considering this to be the plan for 10 or 20 years. I mean, I think when we look at that study, we can, you know, we're going to come back and revisit this.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. We do believe that jobs are a good proxy for overburden. We know that long term they may have some volatility issues in their own right. That's why we wanted to throw it into a temporary fix now, freeze it, and work it with the rest of the factors through a study program to determine what weight jobs should really have and what kind of interaction jobs should have with other factors that are created in a study. But we thought for the time being it was a good proxy, but we would hate to see it become a volatility issue in its own right, and we do believe without careful consideration it could become that. And we do appreciate your efforts to provide some additional money within the inner ring. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Appreciate that very much. Before we have the next testifier, we do have a forum. And so we've got some motions we need to do, and probably going back to the other day, but we first need to move House File 1222. So would anyone care? Representative Dietrich moves House File 1222 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Any discussion on that? All right. So now we need to move, and we have the delete all. And so Representative Dietrich, will you move the author's delete everything amendment? And that is labeled H-1222-DE1, and that be adopted. Any discussion on that? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And now we have an author's amendment to this, and that is the A7 amendment. It makes a few minor changes to the LGA formula, just kind of technical in nature, and gets it into working order. So, Representative Dietrich, you want to carry the heavy, carrying a lot of the heavy lifting tonight.
You're working hard.
Representative Dietrich moves that the author's amendment labeled H12.287 be adopted. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is that all we need to do right now? All right. So, next, if you would introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Cotton Committee. My name is Jan Callison. I'm the mayor of Minnetonka. I'm also appearing tonight as the president of the Municipal Legislative Commission, which is an association of 14 suburban communities. And I have to be truthful and say I'm not sure whether I'm speaking in favor or in opposition to this bill, and I will explain that. There are some provisions that we like, and we like them very much. The first is that we do support direct property tax relief to individuals. That's been part of our legislative agenda for some time, so we think that's a very positive step, particularly for those communities that do not receive LGA. Secondly, we also support the phase-out of the market value homestead credit program. That has put us in the middle of the state's budget difficulties, and we think that's been an unfair position for us to take, and so we're pleased to perhaps not see us be in the middle of that anymore, so we thank you for that. And thirdly, we also support the fiscal disparities study, so we find those three things to be very positive about the bill. What we're not so positive about is the funding mechanism. And partly that's because we may not have enough information to understand that yet, but some of the information we have indicates that it puts as much as $200 million into the system, new money, in fiscal year 2011. That means there's lots of losers as well as lots of winners, and we're not certain who the losers are. Some of the statistics show that it might reach people with incomes of $100,000, that they would begin to see a difference in their properties or their bills, their tax bills, and so we're concerned about that from the standpoint of our residents. We're also concerned about a change in state policy that begins to eliminate the deductibility of those property taxes. So those are our major concerns, partly to understand better, but particularly to understand the impact on our homeowners and what this bill is likely to do to the tax bills that they pay. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did you say that this puts new money into the system?
I show that $197 million of new money.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there's any new money. They're recycling all the old programs, crunching them up, throwing it up on the wall.
Well, this money is
what you're getting. There's no new money.
New money from the standpoint that people who are, say, having one property tax bill will now have a different tax bill, and so there's a new property tax impact.
Let me just clarify. Representative Earhart, you're correct. And what we are doing is there are five direct property tax relief programs in the state of Minnesota. And from the largest to the smallest, it's a property tax refund program. Then it's the market value homestead credit. Then it's the itemized deduction on property taxes. It's the renter's credit, and then targeting. We don't touch the bottom two. We leave those as they are. And we use the available dollars there. In fact, actually, we don't use the market value homestead credit till 2010, when we start phasing in over 5 years. But what we are doing then is putting that back into the mix, restructuring it, and putting it into a more efficient, based on ability to pay, more targeted homestead credit state refund. So there are no new dollars at all into the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Earhart. What I should have said is that you're going to be changing the mix of those dollars and who's going to be paying what, and we're concerned about the impact on our
Absolutely.
Residents.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mayor. Okay.
So am I.
Thank you. We have the same residence in some cases.
Thank you very much. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Engstrom, the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. And just a tiny bit of background, the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, we represent those cities that are population 5,000 and less. We currently have about 370 city members of approximately 600 or so cities in Minnesota that are 5,000 less. We have everything from Kenny, Minnesota, which is a member, a population 6, And I think our largest, Kenny is in your district.
District 90?
Yes, it is, yes.
It used to be four. They've increased 50% when the gainers in the last decade.
I think somebody had twins. Kenny, Minnesota is a member. I think our largest city is Oak Park Heights, which is about 4,600. They're approaching 5,000. First off, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for calling all of the municipal groups together last year and saying, let's get together, get your act together, and come up with something. And we did work hard, and we came up with a great proposal, which you introduced in House File 3756. I also really want to thank you and for your work with small cities and the increasing per capita. Currently, as you know, it's the 2,500 and under get a per capita. The proposal that you have in front of you and what we propose, it goes to the cities under 5,000. We think that is important to have that per capita. You have to remember, cities under 5,000 receive no MSA, no transportation. Even with all the new money going into the system, cities under 5,000 do not receive that municipal state aid. I could say and repeat a lot of what was already said by the previous testifiers here. What I want to tell you is how important it is that the municipal groups are together, that we understand each other's needs, and that we are willing and would like to continue to work together, but how important it is to have some stability for a period of time while we're working on that new formula for what will take a few years. That is very, very important to us. We don't want to be like a large family fighting over the last loaf of, or last slice of bread. It is important for us to have some stability in the formula as we continue to work together. One thing I want to point out, as I said, I want to thank you for including the cities up to 5,000 and getting a per capita of $8. We had originally proposed $12 for those cities up to 5,000. The formula, the way it is now in 1222, House File 1222, there are, I have it here, 291 cities that really do not gain or lose compared to what is 2008. If we would go back to House File 3756, even with the same appropriation that is in 1222, that is reduced. There are less cities that lose. And we know there are winners and losers as we are going to move forward. That is part of what happens. But I think I'll conclude with that. But would like to say thank you. We'd like to continue to work together and would like to continue having some stability as we move forward trying to come up with a new formula.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Next. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Enke. I'm here this evening in my capacity as a research and advocacy director for the North Metro Mayors Association. The North Metro Mayors Association was formed in 1986 to serve as a nonpartisan advocacy vehicle for communities in the north suburbs to encourage private and public investments in our communities for the benefit of all. Currently, we have 19 members ranging from cities like Circle Pines and Lexington and Blaine on the east to Maple Grove and Ramsey on the west, including the city of Minneapolis. Some of our cities get LGA, some of us don't, some of us should, and some shouldn't. We are a diverse community of communities, and that's one of the things that I think we've accomplished in stressing and raising awareness on these last several months. We're not all the same. We turned up our effort on local government aid reform after the 2003 budget cuts that eliminated aid for many of our cities. It adversely affected us, we feel, in unfair ways. The trends and analysis suggested that we would continue to lose local government aid. And we also encountered cities with volatility problems wherein relatively small cities with small budgets were encountering changes in their LGA allocation in the hundreds of millions of or hundreds of thousands of dollars just between the end of the session when we were looking at estimates and the certified numbers that came out a few months later, which makes it very difficult for small cities to do some good budgeting. Based on those issues, we worked with Metro Cities and League and others to put together the working group that you've been hearing about that put together the Unity Plan. In that process, we've learned a lot about the needs of other cities around us, and they have in turn recognized the needs that our cities have encountered. Many of our older, fully developed suburbs have problems similar to cities in greater Minnesota. Some of our fast-growing cities on the exurban areas have problems similar to greater Minnesota and to small cities elsewhere. So it's not an issue of all cities are the same. We are a very diverse community, and that's why it's so difficult to deal with local government aid issues. But we've learned a lot, we've heard a lot, and we've been heard, and we're delighted that we've reached this point of unity. For perspective, and to add a little bit to where some other comments came forward in terms of being encouraged by the chair to get our act together and come forward with a unity plan. Prior to going to work for the North Metro Mayors, I had the honor and privilege of serving for 8 years as a city council member and 14 years as a mayor of the city of New Brighton. So I've been engaged in debates and discussions about local government aid now for over 30 years. And I remember fondly working with John Tomlinson when I was president of the League of Minnesota Cities on local government aid reform. So this is not a new issue for me. And for all of those 30 years, we've been asked by the legislature, by the various chairs, get your act together, come together, and give us a plan that you can all agree to. Ladies and gentlemen, we have done that, finally, after 30 years of asking. And we would like to emphasize that point tonight and to emphasize why we feel that strongly about the unity plan that we provided to you. We have reached a consensus, and there are several parts to that consensus, I would argue. Number one is we all agree that the current formula is inadequate, it's broken, it either needs to be either undergo major surgery or total replacement. We know that the statistical basis that once represented the large share of the statistical variability between communities, which was once in the 60% or 70% range, is now down around 20 or 25%. So we know the formula no longer works as well as it should. We know also that the Unity Plan, as has been mentioned, is not the ultimate fix. It's a temporary stopgap. It's a surrogate that holds us together for a short period of time while we can put together a better plan. That will be difficult. We understand that. Simple questions like, how do you measure need? How do you measure capacity to meet your own needs? Those are some tough policy questions that we need to deal with in these coming years. We are pleased that the committee has targeted $30 million in new funding for local government aid for this bill. We understand and appreciate the difficulty you have in coming up with that money given the budget circumstances you're dealing with. So at the same time, several of our communities in the North Metro area will benefit. Some will come back on the formula, as they should. We hope that the ultimate formula will deal fairly with others. As has been noted, we do have some concerns about the current language as it deals with the volatility issue. We don't feel it deals as well with it as did our proposal. But we look forward to working with you in the coming weeks and months, both on the ultimate tax bill that comes out of this session, as well as the steady process that leads to the ultimate design of a better, improved local government aid formula that deals fairly and that deals simply and with some logic and some explainability to those of us who have to live with it and explain it. Because right now, that formula is very difficult to explain. It's very difficult to understand. It's very complicated. We think it needs to be simple, intuitive, and we'll work with you towards that end. So thank you for the opportunity to be here this evening, and we look forward to any questions or comments you might have.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Come on down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities, and if it's all right, I'll be speaking to non-LGA portions of the bill in front of you tonight.
Mr. Dan Boyd, what, he is, it's unity.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Mayor, Representative Lanning.
That's all right. I still like being called mayor. Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. You run a good meeting, Mayor. Before we leave, I assume that we've heard the testimony on LGA in particular.
I think any more on LGA? Is there anyone else? Okay. Sounds like the LGA testimony is over.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make a couple of points about the LGA issue. I certainly understand and appreciate the fact that the city representatives support the $30 million and that you're disappointed about the $90 million that is not in this bill. I want to make sure that all city officials are properly informed here about what this proposal is. This $30 million does not come out of the current biennium. You know, it's a commitment that we would be making for the next biennium. It would be kind of like city council deciding now to spend whatever in 2010. It's kind of in advance of actually knowing what your revenues are going to be. And normally, for 2010 and 11, we'd be making those decisions next year in 2009 session. And so I think everybody needs to understand it's not money that's available now in the current biennium. We would be pre-committing to the next biennium. And I think that's important for all city officials to understand. Secondly, as has been noted, this proposal changes the formula. And I understand and appreciate and think it's great that the cities have come together to come up with revisions in that formula, and we needed some revisions in it. I think because we are changing the formula, it's good for cities to be able to see what the effect of the changes in the formula would be given the current funding, with no increase in the funding. Mm-hmm. So you can get a real true picture of where the shifts are, because there are shifts. Under this proposal we have before us now, most cities get more money in LGA. Some get some that haven't gotten before. And those who haven't gotten, most of those still don't get. But I think it's important for cities to see what the effect of that, just the raw formula change, would have on the distribution of aid. And so, with that in mind, I asked Ms. Dalton to do a run with a new formula, both on without the $30 million and without the $90 million, so that city officials could take a look. And what I would ask all city officials who are here tonight to do, and I'll ask Ms. Dalton to put these on the web, I would like city officials to take a look at those runs and see if that really is the kind of redistribution that city officials have intended to do with this formula. I don't know that this has been done by any of the city groups. That's why I asked Ms. Dalton to do this, and those will be on the web tomorrow. So I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you. Mr. Gamble.
Chair and Representative Lanning, we have done some of that work. Starting this process a year ago, we suggested that there could be no reform outside the context of growth in the formula, because then we would truly create real dollar winners and losers, and we knew that would just not be acceptable to many folks. So the point of reform is to make some important changes, but we know we have to do it in the context of growing the program, or it will never pass muster either at our level or at yours.
Representative Lanning.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I fully understand that and appreciate it. I just think it would be a good test for city officials to look at it. And is that in fact the kind of redistribution that the city officials have agreed to? That's really my only point.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may be a question for staff, because I haven't got quite this redistribution in my head yet, but would it be fair to say that in some instances, cities could just as well raise their levy to their people as have their people
have their income taxes brought into the formula. By that I mean if they're going to their income tax paying people who are going to be paying more could just as well be levied against rather than having it redistributed. Is that making any sense?
Representative Earhart, I don't know if I'm following you. You mean
fine it against income tax?
Well, you're bringing income taxes into the distribution here, into the formula to... how you're getting part of your money is rearranging the... what?
Right. Representative Lanchesky, did you...
Representative Marquardt, Representative Earhart, as you know, Representative Earhart has this habit of sort of acting like he doesn't know what he's talking about when he actually knows exactly what he's talking about. And he does it all the time, and so people underestimate what he's what he's talking about. And I think the confusion, Representative Marquardt, is folks are trying to figure out where did the money come from for the LGA and county aid?
Oh, very good.
Okay, so where it comes from is the tails in the FOC bill we passed. So that's the money, and that's why it is. In fact, someone, Representative Lanning, said this is happening in the 2011 biennium, which is true because you can't deliver it prior because there is no revenue now. So the tax committee already passed the FOC provision, and that creates tails. The governor spends his tails on things he likes. The Senate spends their tails on things we like. And in this bill, the House property tax chair is spending it on LGA. The other issue of the property tax refund and the buckets of market value credit and PTR funding and the property tax exemption deduction from the income tax are fully revenue neutral and could not be transferred to local government aid or county aid because they're the revenue neutral side of the non-tax aids and credit expenditure part of the budget. So I think, Representative Marker, I think the confusion, and maybe for people in the audience, that's why I wanted to clarify, is where does that revenue come from LGA funding and county aid? It is the tails revenue that was already raised and passed off the House floor for the foreign operating corporations provision.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And of course, the Tax Committee pays for everything here. And, I mean, everything is paid for. There's, you know, everything. It's either through the FOC tails or the revenue neutral of the pot of money that provides direct property tax relief to homeowners around the state. Representative Earhart, did Representative Lanchesky explain that?
Well, that's fine for the moment. Thank you.
Okay, very good. All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, it's Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities speaking to some of the other parts of your bill. First of all, in Article 1, the Homestead Credit State Refund, while we don't have a specific position on what you have right here, we do support the expanded use of the PTR programs to buffer property tax increases, and we support converting the market value homestead credit into a direct payment to taxpayers. We would congratulate you on your efforts to those measures. On the foreclosure efforts that you have coming forward in this bill, we would again applaud your efforts here. The $1 million grant money will certainly be helpful for those cities who are eligible for it. Obviously, there's a lot of need out there. We also appreciate the flexibility in the assessment language that you have in your bill that would apply for certain neighborhoods. And in theory, we also support the what I'm going to call the this old house concept that you have. I would add that we might have some suggestions about sharpening the language to maybe make sure that it really does what you want it to. People have been critical of the this old house program over the years, worrying about some of the side effects to it or in applying in situations where it might not be deemed. So we would like to work with you over the next couple of weeks on that. We would support increasing the class rates on public utility property. We do have concerns about the supplemental notice of proposed property taxes, and I believe the counties will talk a little bit more about that later this evening. Our concerns really deal with the cost of preparing and mailing those notices and whether it might be confusing the property owners relative to the traditional T&T form. We do support the changes in the abatement limit that come forward in Article 3, Section 49. That's the bill that moves it to the greater of $200,000 or 10% of the tax levy. And we also support the assessment of properties of purely public charity language that I know you worked on hard this session. We support this as a reasonable step and believe this process will yield a more thoughtful approach to the issues raised during in the Under the Rainbow case. And finally, the prohibition on local sales taxes that came forward is your legislation, of course, Mr. Chair. We do oppose the section that prohibits local governments from advertising and promoting and spending public money in this area. I just add that, as you know, several of our cities have used this over the years on regional projects that they've deemed at the local level. This would be a good way of funding that. And we just ask that you keep an open mind on this as this bill moves through the process with the other city aids that you have in this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rourke. Ms. Stanboy?
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. Metro Cities also supports the phase-out of MVHC and folding it into an expanded PTR program. We think property tax relief is best done in that way as a direct payment from the state to individuals. We supported that last year, and we support it again this year. We're excited about the foreclosure grant program that you've created here, and we support the fact that it concentrates the money on areas of high concentration of foreclosures, and we believe it directs the use of the funds to the proper places, and that being the building inspection area and public safety departments, those areas that are on the ground that are working real hard to assure that concentrated foreclosures don't result in overall neighborhood decline. We support the foreclosure provision that takes those into consideration in the effect on market value in the neighborhood, and we also support the this old house type legislation. We believe it might need a little bit of work, but we're very excited about those proposals, and we wanted to offer our support.
Thank you very much. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping staff could give me a little more clarity on the foreclosure portion. As I was reading through the summary provided by staff, I'm not quite sure what cities actually would qualify for this grant, these grants.
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, Ms. Dalton really is a better one to answer this because she's the one that drafted it, but I did talk to her a little bit about it this afternoon, and she said that it was not specifically designed just for certain cities, although I think, you know, it definitely would include Minneapolis and St. Paul, but she talked to Tanya Orr over at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and she was the one that helped her kind of come out with those factors. So it was left open-ended as far as who really would qualify other than Minneapolis-St. Paul definitely would because of, I think there's zip codes in there, isn't there?
Yes.
But, you know, as far as other ones, it was not specifically designed.
Yeah. Representative Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, just looking at the language, I asked the question because it seemed very specific, and so I just wanted to know exactly who would be benefiting from these foreclosure grants.
Yeah, Representative Anderson, the intent was, in fact, we received input from a number of city groups that kind of, people that came together, and we were looking for what might be some suggestions for both individuals and communities overall. And it would be those that had a concentration level of 50% or more of the metropolitan average. But it could be a part of a city because it could be one zip code. But the maximum out of this $1 million grant that any one city could receive would be $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a maximum, and I'm sure there's more details that would, you know, probably have to be worked out on that. But Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, perhaps when Ms. Dalton can return, we can maybe get some greater clarity. I don't know if you saw this weekend in the Star Tribune, but there was a huge article talking about foreclosures, and it was targeted on the Wright County area in particular, and they've seen a huge problem. St. Michael, Elbertville area as far as foreclosures, and I'm just curious if this would actually benefit them or if they're not included and if this is just strictly for Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Yeah, I can answer Representative Anderson that it is not strictly St. Paul or Minneapolis. That was not the intent. And I think, especially with the limit to any one city being 250,000, even if both qualified, which I think they will, you know, there's dollars elsewhere. And I also think, if this would become law, that you would look at this $1 million and say, you know, how many cities out there really could use this and divvy that out appropriately. So there's certainly some wiggle room on that, and I understand and appreciate your concerns, but it is for area-wise, and there might be a rural area that also may qualify for some dollars, too. So, yeah. Any other questions? If not, who wants to...
Mr. Chairman, I'm Keith Carlson, and I'm not from a city. I do represent the Minnesota Intercounty Association and appreciate the opportunity to testify in the bill. I want to start off by thanking the chair and the members of the division for the additional $20 million of county program aid. I think at least it's an acknowledgement that we, as counties, not cities, not school districts, are the primary determiner of your constituents' property tax. Our levy in the aggregate is over 50% greater than the city's, yet we only receive 40% of general purpose aid vis-a-vis cities. So we appreciate that $20 million. We also appreciate it since we're the only level of local government, whether we're talking about the House, the Senate, or the governor's supplemental budget proposal that's taking cuts. So we appreciate that there's some offset here. And finally, I hope at least that it's some acknowledgement of the substantial costs that have been placed on us in terms of housing the state's prisoners, paying for substantial portions of the civil commitment process, paying for at least a portion of the care of under 65 disabled individuals for long-term care, and the developmentally disabled, all that have been placed on us since 2003. Again, thank you very much for the additional $20 million that's appropriated for 2009 and beyond. I also want to commend the change in the utility classification ratio. This will provide needed relief for those areas that are particularly hard hit by the new utility valuation rules. I additionally want to acknowledge or commend the changes in the property taxation statute that creates a new classification for unplatted rural vacant land, and also the addition of short rotation woody crops to the ag classification. I think they'll go some distance to address some of the problems or inequities with assessment or classification of those properties. I do, however, need to note several areas where we do have some concerns. Other changes that occur in the bill and the ag classification, as well as the green acres, I think the committee simply does not realize how widespread of an impact that they're going to have in terms of tax reductions for those specific properties that will benefit, and the consequent tax increases on other properties in the jurisdictions where those properties are located. It will create substantial administrative problems for the assessors in administering the new provisions. Although the two provisions, the ag classification and the green acres, are separate portions of statutes, they are tied together. Under both current law and the proposed, you have to be classified as agricultural in order to get the green acres valuation reduction. Right now, so the classification is qualification is the first step, and it's a relatively high bar in that generally you have to be 10 acres or greater in size. So that cuts off most small parcels. There is an exception to the 10-acre limit for property that is intensively and exclusively used for agriculture, such as truck farms. So that's not really an issue. The bill essentially eliminates that size criteria and substitutes for one of five different conditions that, frankly, would be relatively easy to meet for qualifying properties of 5 acres or less. Then in addition, for Green Acres itself, it totally eliminates the 10-acre minimum that applies to that statute, as well as eliminating the primarily used for agricultural criteria and the income limits. The latter, the income limits or the income criteria, was recommended by the legislative auditor to be eliminated in its recent report on the subject, but only if the statutes were also amended to add specificity to the statutes classifying property for agriculture and defining what is primarily used. And quite being frank, the bill does neither. So what's the problem here? There is going to be substantial incentive for people to come forward. First, just the classification change alone will result in a 50% reduction in the taxes on the affected properties, basically those under 10 acres. In addition, they will qualify for an additional credit above and beyond the up to $304 homestead market value-based credit of the ag credit. And their homestead market value-based credit may actually go up under this proposal. And finally, they'll get the benefit of the Green Acres valuation that can only be valued with regard. Again, there's going to be significant properties that probably will qualify under this, and as a consequence, there'll be large tax shifts. I simply don't know if the committee appreciates that or realizes what's being done here. Our second concern is with regard to the special valuation provision for rural vacant land abutting public waters. Quite frankly, it's problematic in that it requires those properties to be valued with regard to other unplanted rural vacant land of similar quality. It's frankly going to be very difficult to find sales of properties that are standalone, unplanted, vacant rural land, because almost always that will be sold in conjunction with ag land. So it's going to be difficult coming up with what the value is in the first place. And secondly, I'd voice a concern about the repayment criteria. It's only 3 years versus 7 years back taxes, or the difference between what the taxes would be without that provision versus what they are under your new Green Acres provision, or the current 7-year term that is required to take a property out of the existing ag preserve program. Going on, we concur with the cities. The truth in taxation changes simply won't work. I have distributed schedule on the back of the two-sided that shows where changes have been made and where, in a number of instances, changes have not been made. For instance, and this is probably the most glaring one, the school levy limitations certification by the Department of Education remains at September 8th. That's more than a week after the school districts are supposed to certify their levies under this proposed legislation, and quite literally they can't do that without the information from the Department of Education. You can change that date, but the department may get up here and testify later on this themselves, but I'll tell you on their behalf, they simply cannot meet that date, particularly in years when there are substantial changes in school aids and levy limits. With regards to those dates that I've indicated, such as the local government aid certification, the fiscal disparities changes, all of which were unchanged under the bill, you can change them to try and address this problem of compressing the time, but the fact is then other problems are created. For example, the state demographers' population estimates are an integral piece of the LGA and county program aid certification. The Department of Revenue doesn't get those until the middle of July, and I'm sure the demographer will tell you that he or she can't get it much earlier. Perhaps the largest deadline that all of us are facing, and that can't be changed, or at least not the way things are currently, is when the legislature concludes. because every year when you pass your new laws, we turn around, whether we're talking about the Department of Education, the Department of Revenue, or the county auditors, and have to make the administrative changes, frequently calling for contracting with third-party computer programmers to change the programming on our computers. And even under the current scheme of things, we go right up to the last minute. For example, Washington and Scott County only got their programs for the new property tax laws for 2008 up and running 10 days before the truth and taxation notices went out this year. And it's not just a matter of computer programming. There's a whole host of manual checks that go through the truth and taxation process. And if there's a glitch on any step of the way, you're simply not going to make it. It's particularly problematic for the smaller counties where the same individuals who prepare the truth and taxation statements are also the individuals who are administering elections exactly during the time you want these revised or new, faster statements to go out. I'll finally mention the supplemental tax increase notice is just frankly, in my opinion, ridiculous. We already have the best informed taxpayers in the nation. They know what their property taxes are each year. They have a comparison right on the statement that they receive. In addition, they receive the truth in taxation statement that tells them what they're going to be. I don't know how many times you have to hit the individual over the head to say, if you don't respond or talk to your policymakers, this is what's going to happen to you. They can interpret the percentage changes on the existing statements. They don't need another one to tell them you better contact your city council person and your county board chair or your school district chair. The information is already there, and I failed to mention there's a third piece of information that required, the advertisement that's required for all counties and the larger cities, as well as the school districts. With that, I'll conclude my comments. Be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Carlson, prior to the election day in November, how many times is the public notified of what the property tax levy is in a city or county?
Mr. Chair, members, the media effectively does that because the levy certificate or preliminary levy certification occurs in September, and I'm sure every one of you has seen the news stories that come out in all the local papers that County X has adopted a levy that has X dollars of increase, X percentage of increase, the same for each city council or each school board. So the information is out there.
I think you know what I'm getting at. How many times prior to election day does the city or county is required to inform citizens of their levy?
Mr. Chair, they're not under current law.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews, representing the Association of Minnesota Counties. In the interest of time, I just want to concur with the comments that Mr. Carlson has made and just add a couple of my own. First of all, on the county transition aid restoration, I just wanted to voice my support for that. It only affects a number of very small counties, but it does effectively correct a problem we have. Counties such as Traverse that are so small, even our formula doesn't pick them up, and so it does help make sure that they get some aid going forward, so we appreciate that. On the issue of advancing the notice process, one other thing I wanted to point out, for smaller counties, it's very difficult if the auditor's office has a one or two person or three person staff to not only administer an election in an election year, but now deal with TNT at the same time. And so it is a concern logistically. The metro counties may or may not be able to pick that process up, but for the smaller ones, they have said that's a concern, that they're not sure if they could implement it without hiring on some sort of seasonal staff and assuming that they can find folks to fill those roles. Also, I just wanted to bring up, last year's bill had a study of the truth and taxation process, and that is something that we still support. We think that a lot of the discussion you're hearing, and I think a lot of Mr. Carlson's concerns, really go back to the point that there are a few fixes that folks would like to see in the process, but we think a thorough review of how we accomplish that and ultimately make the process more effective for taxpayers. And I think we want to make sure that whatever investment cities, counties, schools are making in providing notices and mailing things out, that it's, one, is understandable, and two, is effective. And I don't think we want to add additional costs if there isn't a payoff in the end. And then finally, on behalf of our economic developers, I know there is support for going back and increasing the limits for the economic development abatements, and I thought that that was in here. So I just wanted to say that is something that our folks are keeping an eye on and they appreciate. Thank you.
Mr. Carlson, Mr. Matthews, I do appreciate your thorough review, and as the, you know, I really do, so appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Chair.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Finance Director at the Department of Education. I'll be very brief. Thank you for the opportunity to testify tonight. I just want to say that the Department of Education has concerns about the change in the deadline for the proposed levy certification for school districts. School district tax levy certification is a very complex process. School districts are certifying in more than 50 different categories of school levies. We have a very tight time frame between the end of the legislative session and early September to collect a lot of data from school districts, to reprogram the system, to do a lot of testing for accuracy. We struggle to meet the current deadlines, especially in years where there's a special legislative session or there are major changes in the system. Moving up the deadlines, we think, would just substantially increase the risk of errors or the just simply not being able to get the reports out on time. School districts also need a few weeks to review the data. They make literally thousands of changes in the numbers after they get the initial levy limitations from us as they review and they see the impact of all of their data. We think that would put a great strain on the school districts as well. Thank you.
Mr. Melcher, thank you so much. And we've talked, and I think there are some problematic areas in that we would certainly have to adjust if this became law. So appreciate your comment.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Folkman?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Gordon Folkman with the Director of the Property Tax Division, Minnesota Department of Revenue. The Commissioner had asked me to review the bill and try and kind of identify some administrative costs that might be associated with the new provision. And it's always a difficult challenge to try and separate out the costs associated with new activity or new provisions with any tax bill from what we currently do on an ongoing basis. And so I find it kind of a challenge to try and identify new things that we would be responsible to do and give you some idea what it might cost. So I decided that I thought I'd rather take the time, at least maybe give a higher level view, just to sensitize you to some of the issues or concerns that we have at the Property Tax Division in trying to administer a fairly complicated set of laws that have a number of ambiguities and open to significant amount of interpretation. And it's quite challenging. Let me just tell you that when I used to do a lot of the policy work, I never got a full appreciation for the work that's involved to try and implement in a uniform way some of the property tax laws that we're responsible for. But the property tax, as you are aware, when you go from one session to another, the tax bill probably has more changes in the property tax provision than any other tax type combined. And I think for the last couple of years, though, we haven't had a tax bill, so at least from an administrative point of view, we've had some stability. But one of the things I'd like to maybe share with the committee, some of the fiscal issues or constraints we have at the Property Tax Division, and also maybe talk a little bit about some of the new provisions that are in this particular bill. One of the things I'd like to really emphasize is that the tax system here in Minnesota is fairly complicated. And the complications don't only result in higher administrative costs, but it results in challenges to understand and interpret current law, coming up with guidelines that result in accurate and uniform assessment and classification, other tax administration policies. Not only is it hard for the administrators to deal with this environment, but it's also becoming increasingly difficult for taxpayers to really understand the complexity of the system. And many of the provisions in your own bill starts to try and address some of the issues and concerns that taxpayers have. And so I'd really like to really predicate my general discussion about the complexity along those two lines. It's not only for administrative issues and cost issues, but it's also concerns for the taxpayer to be able to fully understand and appreciate the different tax implications that they are facing and all the laws that impact them. With respect to the particular bill that is coming from this committee, I'd just like to list through a couple of items that contribute to possibly additional costs for the property tax division. But I also at the same time indicate that some of these things are some things we're already trying to do within the property tax division. For example, there's a provision in there that says that we should provide, review and investigate assessment practices when we are get a number of taxpayers soliciting for that. And those kinds of reviews and investigations on individual practices is something we already do, and it's very challenging because they're very time-consuming types of activity. But it's very worthwhile also to do it. So the issue I have here is that these are things we're already doing, but because now it becomes part of a more explicit statutory requirement, one of the things we have to start budgeting for and anticipating for is the potential of a number more of those investigations. The new provisions in the Green Acres and rural land assessment and classification provisions, whenever you have a major change to a program such as that, it creates a significant amount of need to have good communications, develop the bulletins, the guidelines, work with the counties, and so there's going to be some upfront costs in dealing with any of those changes. The reports in the bill, we have two reports that are mandated for the department to do. One is to do a tax status survey on the nonprofit public charities, and the other one is the fiscal disparities report, and that's the one that scares me the most. But that's
Carolyn Chesky at
it. I know, I have to be careful. We have another new program with the seasonal recreational tax deferral program to administer that. Another provision, a special use of properties, the department will be required to provide assistance to local assessors or county assessors. This is something else that we're trying to do also in our strategic planning, to work more closely with the counties, providing technical assistance as part of our strategic planning. The issue I have is to what extent do we now have to speed up the process of getting people trained and averse to, and up to speed on special property assessment issues. We're also trying to work with counties, developing mentoring and other types of programs to utilize their expertise as well. But taking the provisions that's in the bill does potentially require some staffing issues that might come sooner than later because of our strategic planning. A number of other provisions, of course, simply just add on to certain things we're currently doing. I won't get into all the details there. But again, because it's difficult to sort of separate some of the ongoing stuff with the new provisions, it's very difficult to go back to my commissioner and say these are the costs. So what I decided...
That's what we were hoping.
Well...
That's why we linked them up.
My pact here, so I have to be somewhat diplomatic with my commissioners in the audience. I have to at least send some message. In some respects, the property tax division is caught between a rock and a hard place. And I couldn't come up with a better thing. I'm just getting too old. But on the one hand, we're trying to be more proactive with the counties and county administrators to engage our department with them, being collaborative, to try and use that methodology for better uniformity and compliance to tax laws. We think that model works well, but it's also a very time-consuming model. You know, to be able to go out and meet with people, get groups together, talk through issues, so it's very time-consuming. On the other hand, still on the demand side, we're constantly getting new legislation. The legislature is always asking more and more from us. If you went back even to the 2005 session, we've been doing a lot of mandated reports, and those things are all worthwhile. We needed to do them, but the workload just continues to pile up. And then on the other hand, we have the property tax division facing ongoing budget appropriations that are flat or even declining. And when budgets get tight at the Department of Revenue, the primary goal for the department is to protect direct state dollar collection and compliance activities. The property tax division is not considered to be serving a general direct or state direct revenue-generating compliance. As a result, we sometimes have to work very hard within the department for our funding as well. We are currently facing a 3% reduction and planning purposes at the department for the current budget situation. So at some point, here's my point for the committee, is that as the commissioner asked me to look at the bill, we are going to probably come back maybe next week to give you some idea of what the fiscal implications are for administering the provisions, zeroing specifically in probably the provisions that are associated with the fiscal disparity study, the survey for the nonprofit charity, and some anticipated work we may have to do for the special use properties and the review investigation. But we may come back next week with maybe a fiscal note for a position or two to try and let you be aware of some of the fiscal problems that we're facing. The other thing, last but not least, I'd like to let the committee know that the department is reviewing the bill in detail, and we're going to try and provide you with a memo next week, if not earlier, about some of the technical issues or administrative issues that we see that may have to be addressed. And I lied. This last item is my last and final item, is that we are trying to pull together some assessors and getting some other input to try and get finally some input on the Green Acre provisions that are in the House and Senate bill. And our hope is to be able to provide the committee and specifically the authors of the bill with a lot of examples of different types of property or situations and how the assessors would interpret the law as it is proposed in the House and Senate bills, just to make sure that everybody's consistent in what the intent of the law is, the complexities, and some of the implications, even some of the implications that Chief Carlson addressed, too, some things we want to be able to cover, specifically with the authors of the bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for the opportunity at least to sensitize the committee to some of the fiscal issues that we're facing at the division. We're going to try our best, but the system's getting more and more complicated for us to address, and we'll try and do our best. With that, I'll take any questions.
Very good. Mr. Volkman, I want to thank you, and while you're here, I want to say that even though I give Commissioner Ines a bad time every once in a while when he comes before to testify, while he's here, I want to say thank you so much for the work these last couple years on the assessments, the Green Acres, and promoting the PTR program, but it's just a great resource, and it's been great working with the Department of Revenue, and I appreciate that very much, and thank you for your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And hopefully we can get that tax bill off the House floor before you can get all your figures together, so it'll be drawn in on the conference committee before you can get back to us, Mr. Folsom.
Well, I beg at Commissioner Ines' door every day, so I thought I'd try here, too.
Representative Winchesky.
Mr. Folkman, I was just saying to Representative Lanning that maybe you have found the first legitimate use besides tax-based equalization for the fiscal austerity pool.
Uh-oh.
Pay for the study.
There you go.
There you go. Representative Lanning said, put a bill in.
Whatever it
takes. And everyone else trying to figure out how to use it on things we shouldn't use it on.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you that, also, Mr. Folkman, there's more than you who's nervous about that study in this room as Representative P.J. Carlson today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Marty Schmidt, Crowley County Assessor, representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. A lot of sections in this bill will have a statewide impact on assessing of properties. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you for the amount of work that you've done on this bill at this point. Minnesota has a very complex system, I'm sure you're aware of that, and in recent years we have been striving to achieve that uniformity statewide. However, many of the provisions that are in this bill increases the complexity of our already complex system and will challenge us in our ability that uniformity statewide. Article 3, Section 7, rural land, rural vacant land abutting public waters. I'd like to call your attention to some of the items that are in this section that could have major tax impacts. Rural land, vacant land may not be next to or part of ag land. Example would be that property may be next to seasonal recreational land and would not be eligible, thus creating an equity in the assessment. We will have a lot of property owners contacting us to ask us why they're not getting the same treatment as their neighbors. The tax burden does not go away. It simply shifts from one property owner to a different property owner. It adds more complexity to the system. Article 3, Section 8, limits on taxable valuation dealing with foreclosures and with disasters. I'd like to call your attention to some of these items that could have a major tax impact. We'll add more administration and complexity to our tax system. We'll need a definition of restoration and reconstruction. Probably without that, I can almost guess there'll be at least, well, I shouldn't say least, but probably 87 different definitions from every county assessor that's out there, or city, whatever the case might be. The disaster program already does exist. In fact, in 1991, we had a tornado that went through the southeast section, a corner of Brainerd and that surrounding area. And it, I felt, worked quite well, and it did the job it needs to do. There's going to be a tax burden shift in respect to this also. Article 3, Section 9, which deals with a tax impact as well, that would have a major tax impact. The requirement to have 10 acres down to 3 will open up green acres to most ag properties. As well, the results of the changes that occur in Section 20 of this bill will result in residential classes, class properties converting to agricultural classification, will receive ag credits, lower class rates, remove them from operating referendums, and defer local special assessments. Legislation Auto Report has stated that this program is too broad and needs to be more restrictive, not less. Article 3, Section 20. I'd like to call your attention to some of these items that could cause a major tax impact. Agriculture eligibility dropping from 10 acres to 5 acres, and the exceptions that would allow ag class for less than 5 acres will cause a tax shift burden to other classifications such as residential, commercial, industrial, apartments, and seasonal rec classes. Lowering of the ag class threshold to 5 acres and adding 5 exceptions for under 5 acres will also accelerate the conversion of all of residential properties to the ag class. A lot of work has been done by this committee, assessors, Department of Revenue, Department of Ag, legislation staff. While it's not perfect, we look forward to the legislation guidelines that you will be providing. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak to the issues. My counterpart, my Metro counterpart here, would like to, I think that's he, would like to make a comment from the Metro perspective.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm the Hennepin County Assessor. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Offices Legislative Committee. Just want to make a brief comment about the green acres provisions and how they relate to the metro area. In the metro area, we've been administering green acres for almost 40 years. We think we've done a good job at administering it, and it's done what it was intended to do. When it was passed, it was to allow farmers to continue farming at the same time their land was increasing in value significantly due to development. So it's worked in that over that time period. We've had several court cases in the 1990s that helped us define what parcels qualify for green acres, what parcels don't. It helped us define primary use, which we've used as our main criteria in determining green acres for all that time. We think it works well, and we've utilized that. In 97, the legislature also helped us out with some language that clarified that if parcels did not qualify for green acres as under primary use, they could still qualify for some ag classification if they had over 10 acres in production. So that's the criteria we've been using. As we move now from applying green acres in the metro area to applying it statewide, it seems like we're moving to a much broader green acres interpretation. The language in the bill before us significantly broadens green acres in the metro area. Right now in Hennepin County, we have 850 parcels that are under the Green Acres program, and I would only suspect that with this new language, we would have multiple times that many. When that does occur, of course, in the metro area, Green Acres creates a significant benefit to the taxpayer because of the difference in market value and agricultural value. And whenever that occurs, of course, there's a shift of that tax burden onto the other taxpayers. I just wanted to point that out from a metro perspective. The last thing that I have some concern with in the language is the payback provision. In my experience with Green Acres, the largest payback year is always the most current one. So that as you calculate the paybacks, they kind of gradually go up because the market value has increased. With averaging and going back 7 years, it seems like we would be charging too much back tax for the prior years, and we'd actually be possibly requiring a payment of more tax than they actually benefited from over those years. So I think that would be a concern.
Representative Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. May, you were commenting about, I assume, the problems partly from reducing from 10 acres to 3 acres has something to do with it. How else, or maybe you don't think we should treat them, where a lot of immigrants, especially Hmongs, buy those size parcels that would fit in to farm. Do you think they shouldn't be getting that break, or how else would we treat them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulery, I'm not sure of the parcels you're talking about. If they're strictly agricultural, in other words, that's all that's done on the parcel, I don't think there's a problem with calling that agricultural. The Green Acres, of course, is a separate step, and I think we always have to keep in mind there's two parts here. First of all, is the property agricultural, which in itself is one determination, and then secondly, does it qualify for Green Acres? And currently, if you have a parcel, as you describe, I would suspect that has no use on it except agricultural, we would call it that, but it wouldn't qualify for Green Acres unless it has at least 10 acres and is used primarily for that purpose. Where the parcels I'm talking about, where we run into the most problem, is when you take a parcel that's small, has some agricultural use, and now you put someone's house on it. How do you classify that? Is that really agricultural, or is it really residential? That's the question that causes the problem. And this language seems to open not only agricultural class, but Green Acres to all those properties if they have 5 acres.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go to a list now. Marlo Hammerston. And Nan Madden. Wayne Cox would be in the hole. So... welcome.
Thank you.
Marlo Hammerston, chairman of the tax committee.
On the deck, man.
Excuse me. Please proceed. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Chairman of the tax committee of the Minnesota Senior Federation. I'm really here tonight for a neighbor of mine by the name of Ralph Farr. He lives at 5123 Alameda in Shoreview. And he came to me when he got his property tax form and asked me what he could do about it. His property tax is 26.4% of his income. 26.4% of your income. I'd like somebody in here tonight to explain to me how somebody can be forced to pay that amount of his income in property taxes. When you go to the Senate, you're going to have a real tough time, Chairman Marquardt, because the Senate, what they want to do is freeze the senior property tax at the percentage it's going to be next year. So it's going to be more than 26.4% where poor Ralph is going to be frozen. And what relief is he going to get? He's going to get LGA relief. Only trouble is, Shoreview doesn't get any LGA. We're trying real hard though. We're looking for a lot of homes in 1940 and newer and older, I should say, that we can import to Shoreview so that we can qualify. We're taking down several of our stop signs so we can have a few more car accidents, because that's one of the things we're going to have to that we'll get more money if we have that. You know, we had all these people coming before me. I got to apologize for not having my black power suit on tonight with my red power tie. But all those people explained how they want more money, but you got to get it from Ralph. And he's at the limit, is what that is. I'm not sure I know that your new bill is the same as your last one. Can you tell me if it is? Because we liked what you had last time in 2007.
Mr. Hampton, it is the mechanism, the Homestead Credit State Refund, works exactly the same, except we actually moved up the maximum income household from $150,000 to $200,000. The only difference is the funding mechanism this year.
Okay. Then we can approve of it. That was a giant step forward, except for one thing. There is no limit. Every tax in the state of Minnesota, you name it, there's a limit. Tonight, you even talked about limits and grants. So you're not averse to limits, but you're averse to limits for the property tax, and that's wrong. That's causing abuse. Every limit has a purpose, and the purpose is protection of the taxpayer. The one thing I need to ask you, and it wasn't too clear, I don't know if you went over it fast on purpose or not, but tell me about the deductibility of property taxes from your income tax.
No. First of all, how we fund this is, again, we're looking at the direct property tax relief programs that there are in the state, and there's five, and where people actually get money directly, and it's related to property taxes. And that property tax refund program, market value homestead credit, and the itemized deduction on property taxes. And then there's also renter's credit and targeting. What we're doing is we're taking those first three, which includes the itemized property tax deduction, and putting that all into a revenue neutral mix to make a system that is more progressive and based more on the ability to pay, and targets those with limited funding, targets those property owners who need it the most. Those suffering the most pain and burden right now with property taxes will receive the most benefit under this plan. The itemized deduction is the portion on your income taxes where you can itemize, and you do that federally, and then also you come back on the state and you can itemize also, and that would be the state portion of your property taxes that would be itemized. And the amount that you get to itemize, if you're even an itemizer, there's one-third of the people in the state don't itemize, their standard deduction. But of the two-thirds that do itemize, well, not all of them get to apply it, because when they come back and have to bring back their state income tax and add that back, then they become a standard deductor. So it's about a half, about 840,000 homeowners will actually receive a property tax deduction, which depends on your income. So, for example, if my property taxes were $3,000 and I made $50,000, I will deduct it 15%, because that's the class I'm in on federal taxes, and 5.85%, because that's where I'm on federal. And that'll come to about a $611 deduction. So if I'm making $150,000, on the federal side, I'm at 25% deduction, and a 7.05 over here, I get about $960. So one thing about that property itemized deduction is, you and I have the same home, we're paying the same amount of taxes, and yet because I make $150,000 and you make $50,000, I'm going to get $961 of deduction, you're only going to get $611. So there's some problems with that. But that part we do away and put it into a mix that makes things more progressive. But that's the deductibility. And Miss Manzi, if I said something wrong, I was on a roll there, so I thought so you didn't stop me. So, so that's what that deductibility is.
As the old saying goes, clear as mud. Ralph's $9,000 property tax be deductible on his state income tax? Will Ralph's $9,000 property tax bill be deductible on his state income tax? Break that down here and
simple. Yes, it would be. Well, I presume if he matches $11,300, would it be standard deduction? Maybe Ms. Manzi could answer that question. I mean, I would. It depends on what the level of his itemized deductions would be. Because if you're a standard deduction, there's no benefits. I mean, that's probably those who, I was calculating, it gets up to near 49% of those who either are standardized deductors or they itemize on the federal side but can't on the state side. So you have about 48 or 49% of the folks out there that they have no benefit at all from the itemized deduction. I'm going to turn over to Ms. Manzi to see if you can answer that question.
Oh, maybe
this
will go faster if I just get this one thing out of the way. And that is, the word on the street is you're getting rid of it. And that's not what you're doing.
What we're doing is taking those down. Right, we are doing away with the property tax itemized deductions and using those dollars, because it's still part of this pot of direct property tax relief, and we're restructuring it into a more efficient and targeted and more means-tested Homestead Credit State Refund property tax break.
Okay.
Yep.
Trying to get by in time, I'll let it go at that. But
I will say that for Ralph, depending on what his income is, that even though we don't have a 5% limit on that, that on the maximum amounts that you can get on your refund, towards the lower incomes, we've increased that by almost $700. So,
on $9,000, that doesn't amount to,
well, $700 is, I think, a pretty significant addition. I mean, it's not going to bring him down to 5% of his income, but it will get down. And I think this is good discussion for kind of those that you might be asking questions that members were asking. But at any rate, I guess, Mr. Hamilton, I guess if you continue with your testimony, and I don't know, did you want, Ms. Manzi, why don't you answer that one question?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think I would just add two things at this point. One is that the example that Mr. Hammerson is giving, the homeowner will be able to claim the deduction at the state level depending on what his other itemized deductions are. His total itemized deductions, as you have pointed out, would have to exceed the standard deduction amount, which is $11,300 for a married couple filing jointly in tax year 09, for him to be affected by the add back at the state level. The other thing I would point out is that there's some misconception about what it is that's being eliminated. The taxpayer will still be able to claim the federal itemized deduction for property taxes, and the bulk of the benefit from the itemized deduction for property taxes comes at the federal level, whereas you pointed out when you were on a roll that the rates are much higher than the state rates are, and thus the value of the deduction is much higher. So of those numbers you gave, the 600 and something and the 900 and something, nearly all of that is the value of the deduction at the federal level, and that is being left in place. We don't have the authority at the state level to do anything about that. It's the portion that's the state deduction that is going to be added back and eliminated, and that will be a small part of the total numbers that you cited.
Thank you. And if I'm remembering right, and I've been you're schooled the last couple of weeks on all of this, thank you very much, is that but I think about $730 million of it is the federal side, and about $180 million is the state deduction, so it's significantly more. And thank you for clarifying that. So I guess you would continue with your testimony. I'm sorry, we've got Representative Anderson.
Well,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're right that some of us were thinking the same questions that Mr. Hammerstein had. In fact, prior to us having this meeting, I had sent an email to Ms. Manzi, and she was gracious enough to kind of explain this whole portion of the bill. And I think based upon what you said, Mr. Chair, and what Ms. Manzi said, is that there will be some people that will see an increase in their income taxes under this proposal. So you've got to be aware of that, you know. But when we're looking at individual people, we need to know what their income taxes are, what their property tax burden is, to figure out if that would apply to them or not. So, but I appreciate you for raising the question, because I had the same question myself.
I don't know how many...
Mr. Hammerstein?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and the committee members, I don't know how many of you get the Pioneer Press, but a few weeks ago, they published 17 pages of defaults for property taxes. 17 pages in small type. I figured by measuring it, it would be about 3,200 delinquencies in property taxes in just Ramsey County. Now, we have a lot to do in talking about foreclosure. But my Lord, 3,200 delinquencies, you better do something for the other Ralphs around the world and in Ramsey County, because it's not going to hack it if you don't have a limit. And if you say that you're going to get relief by using LGA, the city of Edina, the city of Edina, the city of Edina.
Representative Earhart,
please proceed. We actually want to, we don't want to, you know, give him too riled up to go.
Well, I got to feed him one straight line anyway. You ready? In Edina, you don't get any LGA either.
No.
And then the demography of the 2000 census says that 25% of your people in Edina are senior citizens.
That's correct.
So you're writing off a quarter of your senior citizens in Edina.
Mr. Hammerstein, you're supposed to be asking the questions of you. This has been tough.
Well, I'm open to any more questions, otherwise I'll shut up.
Well, I want to say I appreciate your efforts, and we've talked a number of times, and I'll tell you what, you're very involved with this property tax relief issue, and I just applaud you for that. And I'll tell you, we've come like almost 90% of the way. So what would you...
100%. 100%.
Right.
Thank you. Get a limit.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Madden, thank you. And Mr. Cox is on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden, and I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project, which is an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues, with particular attention to the impact that fiscal decisions have on low and moderate income Minnesotans. And we would like to applaud the committee for addressing a very troubling trend in Minnesota's state and local tax system. Our tax system has been becoming more regressive, and increasing reliance on property taxes is a significant contributor to this trend. So we appreciate the efforts in this bill to respond and to restore a measure of tax fairness to the system. First of all, I want to thank you for rejecting the governor's proposal to cut the renter's credit by 21%. That proposal would have made rental property taxes, which are already one of the most regressive taxes in the state, even more regressive, and would have asked low-income people, including many seniors and people with disabilities, to take on a really disproportionate share of the cost in balancing the state's budget. So we're very happy to see that proposal is not included here. In terms of the homestead credit state refund, it appears to be a welcome step forward in making the property tax more based on ability to pay, and appears it will have a positive impact on tax fairness overall. We're looking forward as this bill progresses to better understanding the nuances of that proposal, but it looks like a very positive and welcome reform to the system. One thing I do want to point out and hope you'll think about a little bit is that that proposal does phase out the market value credit, which is something that folks get automatically, and put those resources into the homestead credit state refund, which people need to apply for. And I know this committee has shown a strong commitment to increasing awareness
of low-income credits and making people more aware and that they don't fall through the cracks. But we'd be happy to work with you and think about ideas to make sure that all low-income folks and people who are struggling know about that credit, are able to apply. And we would like you to consider perhaps increasing the state's investment in volunteer tax assistance. If the new credit is going to follow the same schedule as the PTR, that has a later application deadline, then the income taxes and I believe many of the tax-assisted sites close up after April 15th. So some additional resources to help them continue to help folks into the summer as they're applying for the super PTR, I think would be welcome and make sure that nobody falls through the cracks. So thank you.
Ms. Stamp, thank you, and those are comments well taken. I mean, that is a crucial part of the Homestead Credit Savings Fund is to get the participation up, and I think we really started that effort last year and with the Department of Revenue's excellent efforts in doing that. I think we've set the base, and you're exactly right, that's crucial, but having volunteer health centers after April 15th is an excellent point, so thank you very much. Mr. Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Wayne Cotts. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice. And we're a tax and budget research group whose principal supporters include the Minnesota AFL-CIO and a number of other civic, religious, and labor organizations. And I'm testifying today on behalf of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice and the Minnesota AFL-CIO. Would like to similarly commend the chair for his bill. We think that it's addresses a real problem. Since 2002, property taxes have gone up 80% here in the state. Property taxes have become the default financing principal mechanism for a safety valve in the state in recent years because of limitations placed on the ability of the state to use its own state revenues to deal with state needs. We think that your bill does a couple things very important. One is it provides overall net relief in property tax significantly. We think it's important that the way you've gone about restructuring the property taxes is useful as well. If you go back and look at the tax incidence study from 2007, and you take a look at the percentage of income paid by Minnesotans at the middle income level, and you compare it to the portion of income paid in property taxes by folks at the very top, what you find is that people in the middle pay about 3.6% of their income after all the credits in Minnesota property taxes. People at the top 1%, pay 0.07% of their income, or about a fifth the portion of income paid by people at the very top. The top 5% pay 1.3% of their income, or about a third the percentage of income paid by people at the middle. So what we've happened is the one tax that's really gone up because of a lot of action and inaction at the state level has been a type of tax that has hit people at the middle much harder than most of the other taxes at the state level. Certainly much harder than if the income tax had gone up at a similar rate, or even the sales tax had gone up at a similar rate. So what we've experienced in Minnesota is creating a tax crunch for people at the middle and people at levels below that as well. What your bill attempts to do is to say, look, if we're choosing not to have net new revenue available to this problem, well, at least let's do a lot better job of taking the existing revenues and existing laws that we have, and let's rearrange it so that the additional tax burden that is occurring year in and year out in income property tax increases is done in a way that hits taxpayers more according to their ability to deal with it, more according to their ability to pay. That principle, I think, is a sound one. I think that it'll be welcomed by citizens across the state. The threshold, really, for people who might experience a bit of an increase under your plan is quite high, probably around 160, 170, 200,000, sort of that level. some of those folks would probably get a little bit of a hit. But remember, those are the folks that are up at that top 5% level, and they're paying only a third of the percentage of their income as people in the middle. So what you're asking is those people to do is to have a little higher burden so that the people who have a three times as much percentage of their income in property tax to be reduced somewhat. We think that's a very reasonable request. We think that that down the road that you may want to, if additional revenues become available, think about doing this with additional revenues in the future. But for now, you're certainly wise to start out by saying, look, if we're not going to raise any new taxes at the state level, let's at least use our existing tools in a way that has a much better outcome than we would otherwise have. So we applaud your creativity in coming up with that type of solution. I think that that having been said, that it would be very important that the analysts of the committee come up with some analysis that would specifically take a look at the kind of case examples that Mr. Hammerstein has come forth with over the years, and to vet your proposal to ensure that the structure of it is such that those individuals who are particularly seniors, modest incomes, paying an extremely high portion of their income in taxes, in property taxes, that they would be net winners. I can't for the life of me believe that they wouldn't under your plan. That's the idea behind it. But it seemed to me it'd be useful to do some analysis of specific examples so that Mr. Hammerstein and others would be able to understand fully that would be the type of outcome. A couple of other things. We also agree with Ms. Madden that not changing the renter's credit is to your credit. We are pleased that you are increasing aid to cities and counties, $30 million to the LGA to cities and $20 million to the counties and a little to the townships. So far, there's only been about a third of the LGA cuts that have been brought back over the years since 2001, since 2003. So this would up that percentage up a little bit. We think that's crucial. We're absolutely convinced that the LGA cuts over the years have been a strong problem for Minnesota's economy. We think that the job loss in the form of fewer firefighters, fewer police officers, fewer road maintenance workers and the like has been a contributing factor to our economic decline. It's taken paychecks off of Main Street that get spent at the insurance office, get spent at the drugstore, get spent at the grocery store, get spent at the car dealership. We think that that the fact that those paychecks have been diminished has helped cause part of the economic problems in sort of faces. So we think that we applauded your efforts in that regard because we think it would help have a good stimulative effect in terms of allowing these paychecks to remain on Wall Street, in fact, recover some of the ones that have been lost. So overall, Mr. Chairman, we think that you've accomplished good work here. We urge you to move your bill forward, and hope that you have success.
Mr. Cox, thank you for those comments. And Representative Earhart, do you have
Mr. Chairman, regardless of your philosophy and who your school here, I want to tell you that you are, last year you had a transparent move to raise the fourth income tax bracket. Now you're sliding through the back door to do the same thing. You're reducing, you're increasing the income tax portion of the higher bracket homeowners and the higher income people. And you will see that when you see some runs later. Now, I know where these folks are coming from, and that philosophy doesn't necessarily happen to be mine, but I think that's exactly what you're doing. You're hitting up the high income, the high, the larger values homeowners to satisfy and equalize here. And before, at least you were transparent, you came out and said we're going to raise a fourth bracket, and then we're going to buy down everybody. at their expense. And I think you're doing the same thing now, but you're not being quite as open about it.
Representative Earhart, I think this plan is governor-friendly. It directs relief, which the governor has always supported, direct relief. It's revenue neutral. There are no tax increases. All of the things that the governor has talked about and supported. And, you know, is any plan perfect? No. But, you know, if we don't do property tax this year, when? Well, when do we do property tax relief? You know, it'd be great to rise all boats. But unless the governor can put two or three 100 million new gallons of water into the harbor to raise all boats, we have to make choices. We have to set priorities. And what I hear from folks, and the folks in this book right here, are the ones that are feeling the most pain. And they are the ones that are trying to stay in their homes. Those are the ones who a spouse might have passed away, a spouse might have lost a job, and they're trying to stay in their homes. So I don't think we can wait. Property taxes have gone up 59% in the last 6 years. On homeowners, it's 83%. So what we've done with the limited amount of dollars we have, first of all, we said we're not just going to do nothing because we haven't got any dollars. We said, okay, what is the best way to address those folks that are carrying the heaviest burden of property taxes? And that's what this does. It refocuses, restructures existing programs. There's five existing programs that provide direct relief. I don't think anyone's being secret about what we're doing. We've stated it a couple, three times tonight. But what we're doing is redirecting, restructuring those dollars to do the most good. Like I said, is it a perfect plan? Well, you know, when you're limited dollars, it's tough to rise all boats, but this one, we think, will provide the most beneficial relief to those who need it the most.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're getting the money from the high-income, higher homeowner folks, because they have less of a deduction now than they had before. So that means that they are paying more in taxes. So you are getting this from those folks. And rather than saying, hey, we're going to raise your tax bracket, you're backing into it. Now, I don't want to argue with you anymore. I think that I've looked at a couple of rents, and I think that's the case. Now, that may be your philosophy, not particularly mine, but anyway, you are entitled.
Representative Lentefsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Earhart, and I apologize. I'm getting laryngitis from that Mall of America hearing.
it's from you talking.
That's what I mean. I just have to address the transparency question because, you know, I don't see that there's anything that's not transparent about this proposal. Ask taxpayers to explain the LGA formula. And ask them how transparent that is. Ask them to explain the market value credit on their property tax statement. Ask them to explain how their properties are assessed and valued. Ask them to explain how their property tax burden is based on their ability to pay. I mean, the property tax system by its nature is the most unclear, not simple, complicated set of tax laws you could probably come up with. The rub for that is we could all design a perfectly simple property tax system that's transparent, and it would be completely unfair. I mean, these are in constant tension with one another. Simplicity sort of equals unfairness when you're looking at a tax system, and complication generally gets you more towards fairness. So is it maybe complicated for folks to get their head around? Yes. Is it transparent? Absolutely yes. I don't see that this proposal isn't transparent. I guess what I'd say is, you know, is Representative Marquardt still here attempting to help people with really high incomes and low tax burdens? No, it's just not. We are absolutely making choices. You're right to think about it that way. And we don't, you know, Representative Earhart, where you and I would disagree is, you're right when you can infuse new money into a system
you can sort of say, everyone's going to help, be held harmless, and then we're going to do more. You know, we heard the governor. He's not doing that. We're not doing it either. What we're saying is, within limited choices, we are going to reorganize based on your ability to pay who gets property tax relief. Now, you know, if folks want to say there's an income tax increase, then the governor's got an income tax increase in his proposal. His property tax relief proposal was an income tax increase on renters, combined with levy limits. I mean, I think we all know that all of these property tax relief things, like the renter's credit, the property tax deduction from the income tax form, the market value credit, are viewed pretty much across the board as expenditures. That's what they are. And when you are delivering relief from something to somebody through the expenditure system, through a spending item, you know, you have to make choices. Who's going to get a benefit here? So if you're wealthy and you don't relatively pay high property taxes, yep, you're going to not get as much of that benefit you've been getting. That's true. And if you have high property tax burden relative to your income, you're going to get a break. And that is pretty much most Minnesotans. I guess the issue I have not really with Representative Earhart, because I think he's seeing it right from his philosophy. What I'd say is, you know, this idea that we can't do property tax relief for Minnesotans because we can't bring revenue, you know, we tried that last year. We failed. But, you know, the governor and folks who don't want to base the property tax system on the ability to pay and do something for folks based on their ability to manage this burden need to come forward and tell us how will they address the embedded unfairness in the property tax system. To accept the tax incidence report that year after year says we're getting more regressive, we're getting away from the ability to pay, means we're just all, as tax committee members in both sides, yeah, we're just comfortable with that unfairness. We're just going to live with that embedded, unfair, regressive tax system. And so I guess I would challenge the governor, minority, anyone to give us a better proposal with no new revenue. We'll even honor that, as we have here, that addresses the fact that we are moving in the wrong direction and taxes are getting more regressive and less based on the ability to pay. So, you know, I'm struggling with this too, Representative Earhart, and I think everybody is, but, you know, the box has been put around us that we can't bring revenue to the table, and we really do believe this is a very governor-friendly proposal. And honestly, I think the more people look at it, the more they will understand, as the governor himself says, and many say, you know, you got to make choices. It's limited resources, you got to make choices. And that's what this bill is doing.
Oh, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Representative Lencheski, what I like about the proposal is that it's tying the whole system to ability to pay. And to a certain extent, we already have that with the property tax refund program. The concern I have about this is that this is a major change in the way in which we provide property tax relief. People currently understand the property tax refund system. A lot of people get checks under the current system, and they should. People understand the deductibility of their property taxes because they've been doing it for years. What we've done here is reshuffled the deck, restructured, as the chair has called this. It's a major change. And what I'm concerned about is that a lot of people are going to have a hard time figuring out to what extent this bill does actually provide relief. And some preliminary analysis would show that perhaps some of the folks that need it the most aren't going to get as much as they think they could or should. And some other folks, middle-income folks, in fact, are going to find that they're going to get less relief than they get now. Their burden is going to be increased. But until we vet this, until we really test this out, we're not going to be able to determine that. And that's, I think, what's unfortunate. Mr. Chairman, I give you an A for creativity. I give you an A for trying to come up with a new plan here and targeting it to income.
But I give you an incomplete when it comes to what is the real impact of this. I think we need more testing to really see, are the people who need it the most getting the kind of relief they need? Are we affecting middle-income people, not just high-income people? Are we affecting middle-income people by actually increasing their tax burden overall? We really don't have the kind of definitive information yet we need to make a full evaluation of this.
Representative Lanny, and those are all excellent points. You know, as you, there's several moving parts in all this. You've got your household income, and you've got, you know, what your property taxes are, and you've got the deductibility and that. But one thing we found out when we, you know, we kind of match up the average to the average, you know, the average household income to the average property tax at the average rate, in both the rural areas and in the metro areas, you benefit, and actually quite significantly. Now, just for some numbers here on, you know, and this comes from House Research, but there's about 1.5 million homeowners. 1.5 million homeowners. About 33%, or 500,000, will not have any itemization. So it's no impact. And so if they, in fact, have property taxes that are, you know, 2% over their income, or their property taxes are 2% or more of their income, they would be income qualified for the Homestead Credit State Refund. So I would think a number of those people would benefit. And at the worst, they would stay the same, those 500,000. Many would benefit, and at the worst, they would stay the same. Then you have about 1 million homeowners that itemize. But approximately 10%, total of 156,000 of those would, even though they could deduct federally, because of the, they have to add back the state income tax, they would not have a state itemized. And those folks, again, if their property taxes were more than 2% of their income, they would income qualify potentially for the Homestead Credit State Refund. So those folks, again, can't lose anything, can only gain. So the two groups I just mentioned would be about 44%. So we're starting out with 44% of the households can only gain in the system. They can't lose. That's 44% already. So now you've got 844,000 homeowners left. And according to research, of those 844,000 that actually are going to have itemized property taxes that would be reduced, 600,000 would income qualify. Oh, no, actually, they would qualify for the Homestead Credit State Refund, meaning that their taxes are more than 2% of their income and they're less than 200,000. So 600,000 of those 844 would see a loss of the itemized, but also they get a Homestead Credit State Refund. Where that goes, you know, we don't know where the mix would be. And it leaves about 16% that would have the property tax itemized deduction and would not qualify for the Homestead Credit State Refund. So there's 16% that would not benefit at all. But I think just looking at that, and just what I've read here looking at these numbers, you're going to have a lot more gainers in the system. And, you know, what you could do, I mean, if mathematically you could punch in any scenario. Have one thing I did is I went on to a lot of the legislators' websites, and I know it's 2,000 data, but I went on to that demographic portion you can go, and I went and took median household income and median house value, and then I went to that city and took the tax rate, roughly, and then it was somewhat prehistoric the way I'm doing it, because I have, but in all of those cases, they benefited. Even if they, you know, and I assumed in every case that they had the property tax itemized deduction. In every case, I assumed that, even though I know that 44% for sure weren't. But I assumed there, and on every one of those that I did, and I probably did 10 or a dozen, in those, using the medians, it came out they benefited from this program. So certainly, as Representative Winteski said, if your property taxes are low in comparison to your income, you're not going to benefit from this. And, you know, the property tax deduction, itemized deduction center. But, again, you know, and, you know, this is excellent discussion, but
The fact of it is, we tried to produce a plan that we thought was really viable. You know, last year's one with the fourth tier income tax, we knew that portion of it wasn't going to go. But we sat down and said, how can we solve this problem of high property taxes with limited dollars and get it to really make a difference to those who really need it and make a viable plan that we seriously thought the governor would consider. You know, it's revenue neutral. 80% of the plan is direct relief to property owners, which I know the governor and members here all support. I know that. And that was a big thing we had last year. Mm-hmm. And no tax increases in the plan. And we think this has or should have serious consideration. So it's certainly, as I said, it's not perfect. But I do think we can say fairly safely that more are going to benefit than would not under the program. Is everyone that made a struggle? I mean, we don't know that, and you can come up with scenarios, I'm sure, and so forth. But if your property taxes are high in comparison to your income, there's a very good chance you're going to benefit, and in some cases, very significantly. So I appreciate the discussion, and we've looked at this an awful lot and tried to analyze it, and certainly wouldn't be putting it out here if, as we looked at it, it didn't seem to work. And so, but there's a lot of mechanics to it. Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And our job is to be testing how we can best provide property tax relief. That's clearly our job. I hope you understand and appreciate that we've had 2 days to, only 2 days to really digest this. This was a whole new approach, whole new plan, revealed. And my only point is that I think the only way someone can really tell whether they're going to be better off, have more relief under this plan, is to bring it to an accountant. And we're going to need a whole lot more analysis to really determine if people are really benefiting like we hope they are, and if in fact we're also raising the burden for middle-income folks. And I've seen some preliminary analysis that would suggest the middle-income people are going to actually have their burden increased, not decreased. But my point is, we need to test this, Mr. Chairman, and we need more time to do that.
I appreciate that, Representative Lanning. Representative Lumchevsky.
Well, just a point to that. It is complicated and it's difficult to know, because it's not like if you raise the income tax to this percent, revenue can give us an estimate, and there you go, that's how much money you get. Or if you raise the sales tax a quarter of a cent, percent, you get this. It's because it's literally independent. All individual homeowners all have a different tax return. They all have a different liability. They all have different deductions, different amount of kids, different mortgage deduction, all kinds of stuff is going on. And then they have to get down to their federal liability. So there is, Representative Lanning is right, that if in theory, in every income bracket, if you don't have high property tax burdens, if relative to your income you're really not paying anything in property tax, you're not going to get more relief. It's directed to the people who need the relief. So that's right, and that's by design. I guess the other thing I'd add in Representative Marquardt explaining the groups of people who get the certain amount of relief, the one thing to note is even the folks who ended up in that final $60,000, they would have an increased federal liability and therefore a higher federal property tax deduction. So, there are many pieces moving around, and it is complicated, and that's because it's an attempt to gain fairness. Mm-hmm. And when you can't bring new revenue in, you are stuck with saying, we're going to help out the people who need it the most. And some folks who have been getting a pretty darn good deal for quite a while are not going to get quite as good of a tax benefit as what they're used to.
Any, Ms. Madden and Mr. Cox, see what you got going here around this. Representative Earhart.
Wow.
Chairman, this is Jurgen.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned 16% of something or other didn't have any, whatever that 16% you got down to. If I remember the old tax charts, there were like 10% of the folks paid about 50 or 60% of our income tax. But I don't know if that's correct or not, but there were somewhere around there. So maybe we're doing that same thing. They're still paying. That was 10, 15 years ago, and I don't have my little tax book here. And there is a tax increase here for those folks. So we're not writing general income taxes or general property tax or general state general taxes, but we are raising taxes for some of the folks.
Representative Earhart, when the state does nothing this year, we raise property taxes.
I didn't hear anything to do with that. But every one of these local officials out here in the assessors are the ones you can blame for that. Thank you.
I won't comment on that one, Representative Earhart, that you'd be here a while. But thank you. Any other questions for our testifiers up there right now? Thank you very much. We have Ms. Abner, who's been patiently waiting. Remember, there is a second feature tonight, immediately following. I can see Representative Bela Forrest and Representative Simpson in these tax people. We're just kind of trying to... Very good. Representative Bela Forrest and Representative Simpson, you cannot vote on the amendments as they come up, because I think there's more. It's starting to even off here a little bit, so... thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My comments will be very brief. We simply wanted to thank this division for supporting the moratorium that will enable nonprofits to really stay at the status quo level relative to the assessment of their tax-exempt status. While we continue to work with you, with legislative staff, with the Department of Revenue, and with assessors in moving toward legislation that we hope to bring forward in 2009 that will address the problems created by the court decision in Under the Rainbow. This has had, I think, a lot of discussion in this committee, and we have appreciated the strong legislative support for the moratorium, and that's on behalf of the Council of Nonprofits and 2,000 member organizations. Thank you.
And Ms. Abner, thank you for your very good efforts on this. So thank you very much. Mr. John Pratt.
Please, I spoke in his
place. I'm sorry. Very good. Mr. Bradley Peterson.
No.
And then Mr. Bob Hill is next, and then that's on the list, and then we'll... Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bradley Peterson, and I'm here representing the Coalition of Utility Cities, which are the cities of Becker, Cohasset, Granite Falls, White Lakes, Monticello, Oak Park Heights, and Red Wing. And first off, we want to thank the division for including the class rate increase on electric generating utility property, moving it up from 2 to 2.8. As I'm sure you all recall, the class rate change was included in last year's vetoed tax bill at a class rate of 3. We are now down to 2.8. This is all... necessitated by a change in the Department of Revenue's rules for how they value utility property that does create a shift of about $34 million onto other property taxpayers, including residential homeowners, other CI properties, you name it. This is also on top of property tax reductions that happened in 2001 when the class rate was reduced from a level that I believe was above 3 down to 2.0. And so all of the communities that do host this utility property have experienced significant tax burden shifts onto their homeowners as the utility property has been devalued, and also as the class rates have changed. The chart that I handed out is actually something that as you did your tour of the state right before session, that you handed out to people. And as you can see from this, public utility property is the only class of property that has seen a reduction since 2002. They are the only class of property that has seen a reduction. Compare that, of course, to the 78% for residential homestead folks. Finally, I do want to note, though, one concern with the division's bill as it's been framed up this time. Previous bills, including last year's veto tax bill and also a proposal earlier this year, did include a class rate increase on personal property, utility personal property, from 2 to 2.25, and that property includes things like pipelines, transmission lines, other equipment that is related to electric generation. And while I understand that you're not doing it this time is in response to concerns about perceived unfairness vis-a-vis the pipelines, I think we still do need to know that because of how those all grouped together, because you do have the transmission lines and other equipment, that not all types of property within that class are operating the same way, and so the cities will be experiencing a reduction because of not increasing the class rate on that personal property. That's the only concern that we have. Again, Mr. Chair, thank you for including this again. You've had a very robust discussion about fairness, and this provision we feel is a very fair one vis-a-vis this problem.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As I'm sitting here listening tonight, do you remember when I was a student at Georgetown, I asked Senator Russell Long when he was leaving the Senate Finance Committee if he had any sage words of advice to the folks that came after him, and he said, yeah, just one, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that man hiding behind the tree. And I really commend the committee, actually, for everything you're trying to do in the fairness area. I'm here basically as a practitioner, Mr. Chair. I have done property tax for industrial and commercial taxpayers for about 18 years now. And I've done pretty much all the food processing plants in the state. I'm currently involved in some litigation that I'm sure this committee knows about, at least at some level, involving sugar beet co-ops. And I'll be real brief. The concern we have after the Supreme Court decision in our case is that back in 1986, the legislature enacted an exception to an exclusion. As this committee knows, the equipment that's used in the production of a product or distribution of a product has always been treated as exempt as machinery, even if it is a large tank or what have you. And there was an exception to that in 1986 that basically had to deal with the raw malting plant in Shakopee. Since that time, there's been uniformity, I think, statewide in terms of how these production tanks have been assessed. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case. And essentially, what it comes down to is this, is that in 1986, the legislature enacted a provision that made the exterior shells of certain structures taxable as real property, even if they are treated as equipment. And the test has always been a function test, whether the tank is used in the production of a process or whether it's used to store like oil or gasoline or what have you. The provision that you have put in the bill, which we appreciate, would ask the Department of Revenue to assist local assessors in establishing the market value of industrial special use properties. They've actually always had that in their bulletin to assessors. They've always helped. But, and I don't know that this session is the time to do this, but I think this problem may come up again. It might become more widespread. And basically, I'm just here tonight just to kind of give the committee a heads up that if we're not able to get some uniformity, we are going to have a problem because most of the county assessors just simply don't try to tax the exterior shells of these tanks. Very difficult to establish establish a value. An example I like to use is this. I bought this egg for 10 cents, so you could say that its assessed value is 10 cents. Now, can anybody tell me what the value of the shell is? And the answer is nobody can because they don't sell that way. There's no market data. There's no way to establish a market value for the exterior shell of a structure. And that can lead to mischief, and it has led to mischief. So I commend the committee for, you know, this problem has not been well aired. I talked to to Mr. Cummings this morning, and this is really an issue that probably will carry over next year if it can't be resolved. We do believe that the Department of Revenue, people like Mr. Hagan, understand the issue, and as a practitioner, all I really want is to make sure that there is that uniformity
and that my folks don't get taxed at millions of dollars on their tanks while other tanks down the road either are exempt or taxed at $5,000 to $10,000 in assessed value. So I'm not taking a position on the bill. We can work with the Department of Revenue. I know private practitioners can, we always have, and I commend the committee and you, Representative Marco, for even putting this in given the nature of the issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hill. We have Mr. Reinberger. In that? Mr. Reinberger is the last one on the list, but others are welcome if they... Oh, I'm sorry, we have one more. Very good. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Joe Reinberger with Xcel Energy's Tax Department. Thank you for giving me time on the agenda this evening. I'm here to speak in opposition to the proposed utility property tax class rate increase contained in House File 1222. The bill calls for a 40% class rate increase for electric generation equipment, resulting in an increase in our annual property taxes of about $6 million and $10 million in pay 2009 and pay 2010, respectively. Besides the increase in taxes that will be passed on to our ratepayers at a time when our economy is in recession, with skyrocketing prices for necessities like gas and groceries, Xcel opposes enactment of these provisions for two main reasons. First, the class rate increase in effect continues a revenue stream that was based on inaccurate valuations. The class rate eliminates the effect of the Department of Revenue's corrected property valuation rule. This change penalizes electric utilities for seeking accurate valuations of their properties. We feel it's reasonable to have asked that our property be accurately valued. However, we recognize that the correction would have an impact on local government revenues, and we took steps to mitigate it. For years, we chose not to challenge our valuations in court, even though the court was deciding similar cases in favor of the utilities, because we did not want to impose retroactive tax judgments on our communities. Instead, we pursue the rulemaking process, which is prospective and can be implemented flexibly. We supported the three-year phase-in of the corrected valuation rule. We supported the transition aid in the governor's budget. We're invested in our communities. We have thousands of employees who live there, and we've taken steps to mitigate the correction of the utility company valuation rule. We initiated work on revenue stabilization agreements with our most significantly affected communities to make in lieu of tax payments to maintain the revenue stream to them for 10 years after the rule took effect. We have signed agreements with Red Wing and Goodhue County. Under the agreement, Xcel will fully offset the effect of the valuation rule for 10 years. We believe it's reasonable to ask that our property be accurately assessed by the state. We oppose increasing utility class rates in order to continue a revenue stream that was based on inaccurate property valuations. The second reason we oppose the utility class rate increase is that due to significant ongoing capital investments we are making in our plants, the new DOR rule is not having the anticipated effect on our host community revenues. This is evidenced already in the first year of the new DOR rule. Overall, there's an increase in tax of three of our five largest plants for pay 2008, with slight decreases at the other two. At our King plant in Oak Park Heights, for example, our tax bill increased 57% from $1.9 million in pay 2007 to $3 million in pay 2008. In the future, their tax bases will continue to grow. Capital investments in our plants alone in the next few years will add $390 million to the tax base in Monticello, $400 million to the tax base in Red Wing, and $400 million to the tax base in Becker. Statewide, electric utilities have just begun a $1 billion expansion of the transmission infrastructure. And what I'd like to do now is pass out a chart that shows Xcel's property taxes over a five-year period. Just take a quick minute while that's being passed out. Continuing, then, the top line represents the property taxes that Excel paid in 2006, 2007, what they'll pay in 2008, and what they're projected to pay in 2009 and 2010. This incorporates planned net taxable investments by Excel, ignores all other tax-based growth in the communities, and factors in full implementation of the new DOR rules. You can see the asterisk indicates when the first year of the DOR rule was put into effect, which is pay 2007. The lower line is the approximate level of tax we would have paid if we were taxed like other businesses in the state, basically taxed only on the land and buildings. The difference there is the personal property tax, approximately 75% of what we pay is personal property tax. Communities that host power plants benefit by far the most from the personal property tax. However, I'm not here today to propose eliminating the personal property tax. I just want to let you know that the main point of this graph is that it clearly illustrates that despite full implementation of the new DOR rule in pay 2009, despite any utility class rate increases such as the ones contained in House File 1222, and despite any growth in communities where our plants are located, our taxes will actually increase to levels paid before the new rule was implemented. One final point I want to make is that the analysis of the impact of the new DOR rule done by the DOR, while comprehensive, is a static model. It did not account for any growth in host communities, much less our expected capital investments to the tax basis. It did not factor in the so-called bounce-back factor, the idea that a taxpayer comprising a large part of the tax base absorbs a corresponding percentage of any tax rate increase. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Not. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, Mr. Zupplinger.
You would...
Thank you for being here, and please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Rapplinger. I'm Vice President of the AFL-CIO Retiree Council. This is a state council that represents all of affiliates across all retiree affiliates across the state of Minnesota. We have currently close to 200,000 retirees in this state. We have some real concerns and have consistent concerns regarding the ever-increasing property taxes in this state. Retirees are on, as we all know, typically on fixed incomes. In many cases, the property taxes are taxing retirees out of their homes, forcing many to leave this state. It is not based on the ability to pay, and it is ever increasing. We appreciate your efforts to attempt to address this. It must be addressed. Secondly, it's very complex, and it still is complex. And I know there was discussion about people that understand and don't understand this. A large percent of our taxpayers do not understand the property tax system.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't understand it, there is high anxiety and there is anger. There is a lot of anger out there, let me assure you. I really appreciate the effort you're doing on this because it is of great concern with seniors. I do have concern, possibly you could answer this. The freezing of the market value in 2009, as I understand, is that part of the legislation?
I don't believe so.
You're not freezing. Okay.
No, we're
no freeze. Okay.
No,
all right.
There's no freeze.
I'm glad that that is clarified. Because we have a situation where the market values, as I'm sure many of you are aware, are decreasing significantly.
Yeah, well, there's no freeze. Yeah.
And one of the concerns I had, if you were freezing market values at 209, where everything goes from limited market to full market value as far as taxation, that would be very, very abusive. I'm glad you clarified that. We do have a lot of inequity, as I'm sure you're aware, of market values and limited market values within counties and in between counties. And that is posing significant problem. So anyway, these are the concerns that we have. We appreciate the effort that you are doing. It's a step in the right direction, but there is a lot more that needs to be done. And I realize with the budget crisis, etc., you are have some limitations here. But just realize that you must proceed ahead on this in the future, and whatever legislation gets passed at this point is not the end of property tax reform. This state has got to make reforms, or you're going to lose a lot more seniors than you've lost now to other states. So I appreciate your time. I know it's getting late. Thank you much.
Mr. Rappinger, thank you so very much. And I think the fact of trying to simplify this is important, and something we've talked about. And we think the Homestead Credit State Refund is simple, 2% up to 200,000. 2% up to 200,000. So if you actually would put a concept of 2% of your income on property taxes up to 200,000, I think actually just that concept would simplify the property tax system. At least people would know somewhat what they're going to pay from year to year.
Right. I certainly agree with that. And I just want to mention, I certainly support Mr. Hemison and Mr. Cox's proposals and comments. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rappinger?
Yeah, I think someone has a question for you.
Well, I think that's a question, though. I guess maybe more clarification. I don't know if staff can maybe help us. I think you mentioned the limited market value. Isn't that being phased out?
Representative Anderson, P09 is the last year, and then in K010, it's completely
gone. So the program's gone after that. Yeah. So nobody
exactly.
will
see a tremendous surge for a lot of taxpayer property, homestead property, because the limited market value has limited or graduated the increase. We're going to see a tremendous surge unless there is some other legislation after 2000 or to address this coming up in 2010.
And Mr. Chair, Anderson,
we don't extend it in this bill, do we?
There are no extensions in the bill. Right. And for residential homestead, the part that's excluded right now is only about 1.5%.
Right.
Most of it is cabins and farmland are the two biggest areas. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other testifiers? Thank you.
Real quick, Mr. Chair, my name is Rob Bonasek, on behalf of Renville County. Didn't plan to give any testimony this evening on Section 2 of Article 3 that provides that the Commissioner of Revenue can assist local assessors in the valuing of special use industrial properties. Mr. Hill had come up and testified in front of the committee. And just by way of background, as members of the committee think about the issue going forward, that his client sued Renville County in tax court, lost, appealed it to the state Supreme Court,
lost and are trying to retry the case to a certain extent at the legislature. And as he used the egg prop over in the Senate at that hearing, Senator responded by asking him, with all respect, what good is the egg without the shell? So I'll let the members of the committee reflect on that, and thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Anyone else here to testify? If not, I think, members, we've had a lot of discussion and so forth. Are there any amendments? And we can... Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
As I indicated to you the other day, I do have an amendment, and you indicated that don't worry about form, just bring
looks good,
bring it.
Lanning.
I had intended to bring it fully formatted, but we had a little misunderstanding about who was going to ask House Research to do it. So House Research has bailed us out, and the amendment that is being passed out is the same language with just an update on the date that was passed in last year's tax bill regarding two-year extension of limited market value. And this committee considered that, and this committee voted to include it in our property tax report last time, albeit a split vote, and it was adopted by the full tax committee last year and by the House, and it wasn't in last year's tax bill. Mr. Chair and members, while we've seen some evidence that home values and are kind of leveling off and, in fact, in some cases actually going down, we still have, I think, many parts of the state where home values continue to go up at pretty good rate. And when it comes to seasonal recreational property, we have not seen much fall off at all. There continues to be a lot of high percentage increases in market values for seasonal recreational property. And Mr. Chair, with the elimination of the deductibility of property taxes on seasonal rec, I think that further exacerbates the plight that seasonal rec people in particular are going to experience. And so, Mr. Chair, I would move the A 2362 amendment.
Representative Lanning moves the A 2362 amendment. Representative Lanning, I do appreciate your push on this very much so. And I know we have at least one other Representative Tidmore who's always been an advocate of this also. And I'm going to speak against this. I know Representative Winchesky and I have talked about this. And actually, since 2004, we only have about $18 billion of market value excluded now. That's down over 40% from like 4 years ago. So it's moving in the right direction. And basically, of the excluded property, seasonal rec's about 17.1%, ag land's about 7.7%, according to the 08 Department of Revenue study, and the residential homesteads about 1.5%. The net impact on residential homesteads, which of course we're trying to cut taxes, is an increase of about $20 to $21 million. When you limit it somewhere else, it's pushed somewhere else. And when you look at the chart, the two main groups that end up paying are residential homestead and commercial industrial. And the ones that end up benefiting, as Representative Lanning said, are the seasonal rec and agricultural land. So, members, I will be voting no. And any other comments? Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Limited market value basically delays some of the value being turned into a tax. The increase is still there. People still pay. Their value goes up. They still pay more tax based on their value increases. And what limited market value does is to delay some of that so that they aren't hit with a huge increase from 1 year to the next. I think it's eventually, I hope we can eliminate it. And my amendment
still calls for its elimination.
Yeah.
And pay 12 as opposed to pay 10.
There you go.
So, Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call.
Representative Lanning, request a roll call. Representative Tamar.
Mr. Chair, just real quick. I support the amendment. I think I see no problem with delaying the phase out for a couple of more years. The economy is bad. Districts like mine, I know other districts throughout the state, you know, like the testimony that we've heard today, people are getting pushed out of their homes, and this provides a cushion for some hefty property tax increases, and this is the time to do it. And I hope the committee would support the Lanning Amendment.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? If not, we'll go to roll call.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Brown?
Yes.
Representative Demmer?
Yes.
Representative Dietrich?
Yes.
Can we just stop?
Representative
Wait for me.
Yes.
Representative Lanning?
Yes.
Representative Lincheski?
No.
Representative Loeffler?
No.
Representative Mullery?
No.
Representative Tamar?
Yes.
Representative Lanning, you gained the vote from last year. The motion does prevail 7-4. The amendment is about, the A-2362 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further amendments?
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Lincheski.
While you're waiting, did you know that it's Representative Seifert's birthday?
Representative Seifert, would you please step out here just a second? And I saw your children with you today. If you could stand up so everyone could see. It is Representative Seifert's birthday today.
Okay. Yay!
And it's happy birthday.
I feel bad for you guys around the table. I feel bad for them, but I don't have enough ice cream.
Are there still some left?
I
can get moving in
a hurry.
Behind you.
Oh, we do. Okay. Well, members, feel free before they melt. So
happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday. Thank you so much. We have another event. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what this amendment does is, I have a lot of concerns about the language dealing with the electric generation facilities and the impact that it would have on other consumers. We heard in testimony today that there would be a $34 million shift onto other utility consumers that don't reside in the cities that were listed by one of the testifiers. And that includes, you know, people in my district, including everybody down the line here that don't have cities that would qualify for this break. And so I just want to make sure that we're not adding more an increase in utility rates for our consumers in our area. So it's removing that language and making sure that we have affordable utility rates.
So Representative Anderson moves the 8-8 amendment. Any discussion on that amendment? Members, I ask that you vote no. One of the things, when the governor presented his plan and had provided some aid for cities, the problem is he only addressed the ones that really were getting hit the most. And if you look at the runs in that, you've got a statewide number of cities and counties that are losing aid. And we feel the best way to kind of rise all boats on this is to raise those classification rates. And while the Department of Revenue and Assessors can set what the market value is, it is in fact the legislature that sets the classification rates on properties. So, members, I'd ask a no vote on this. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I'd like a roll call on this.
Representative Anderson calls for roll call. Any other further discussion?
If not, we'll take the roll call on the 8 amendments.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Brown?
No.
Representative Demmer?
Yes.
Representative Dietrich?
No.
Representative Earhart?
Yes.
Representative Lanning?
Yes.
Representative Lincheski?
No.
Representative Loeffler?
No.
Representative Mullery?
No.
Representative Paymar?
No.
The A8 amendment does not prevail. 4-7, the amendment is not adopted. Any further amendments? Any further discussion on the House File 1222? If not, I just want to quickly say this. Oh, we need to pass minutes.
We'll do that right after.
Okay, we'll do that right after. But, all right, we'll do that. Anything else? We have, Representative Dietrich renews her motion that House File 1222 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail, and that will go on to taxes. We have the minutes, and there needs to be one small amendment, and where it says members absent, that should be members excused. So with that, do I hear Representative Demmer, would you care to make that motion?
I do.
April 21st amendments. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. Members, thank you so much. I appreciate the discussion. Debate has always been dignified and focused on policy, and I just appreciate everything you brought to the table. I just really do appreciate the committee for that. And Representative Chesky, are we going right into taxes? There'll be a 5-minute break. Thank you so much. We are adjourned.